Welcome back, guys. My name is Jessica J. Sudhasan. I'm a law student here in Toronto, Canada. And this is part two of my interview with Australian Tamil author Shankari Chandran as part of SLWB's Speakeasy podcast series. Shankari has written three books, The Song of the Sun God, The Phantom Limb, and The Barrier, all of which are set in Sri Lanka and explore the issues at the root of Sri Lanka's conflict through its past, present, and future. Song of the Sun God has recently been shortlisted for the Fairway Gall National Literary Prize in Sri Lanka and has been optioned by an exciting television and film company, which hopes to make a six-part television series out of it. You can get your copy of Shankari's novel, Song of the Sun God, via her website, shankarichandran.com, and also through Tamil Culture's online marketplace, TC Market. In part two, we discuss her third book, The Phantom Limb, as well as media suppression in Sri Lanka, the current state of political activism among the diaspora, the role of literary fiction in countering political fictions, her hopes for Sri Lanka's future, and we finish with a lightning round so that you guys can get to know Shankari a little bit better. And now, back to the interview. I want to talk to you about your third book, The Phantom Limb, which is set in Sri Lanka at the end of the war in 2009 and centers around Ellie, a human rights lawyer for the U.S. State Department, sent back to Sri Lanka to investigate the murder of a high-profile journalist who was executed in the streets of Colombo in broad daylight. What was your motivation behind writing this particular book?
The seed for the story came to me in 2013 when I was reading a lot of academic books on Sri Lanka at the time, and in particular I was reading Gordon Weiss's book The Cage. And there are two case studies in it that he explores. One is the execution of French humanitarian aid workers that happened, I think, in the east of Sri Lanka. And the other was the assassination of Lasantha Wickramathunga, which happened in January 2009. And both of those incidents really stayed with me in a very visual sense. I couldn't quite shake the image of these aid workers who had been executed, and I couldn't shake the image of gunmen opening fire on the car of a journalist who himself had foretold his own death and whose primary purpose had been to shed light on injustices committed by both sides of the conflict. You know, Lasantha Wickramathunga's politics were very broad spectrum, and he was very much about the search for truth and had not aligned himself journalistically with anybody other than the truth. And so I began with those two images or those two stories in my mind. And I think for me, I'm not yet done with Sri Lanka. I know that sounds like a strange thing to say. I think, as I mentioned before, my first book is about the past and the mistakes that were made that took us to Sri Lanka's civil war. And the second book is about the future and what will happen to Sri Lanka and to the world if we don't try to learn from those mistakes. And we seem so doomed to repeat those mistakes. For me, the third book is the piece that connects those two novels. It is for me a trilogy, actually, even though it's not a sequential trilogy, nor does it have common characters. But it's a personal trilogy, as it were, because that third novel connects the past with the future, focusing on that one moment, focusing on 2009, which was the climax of the war. And it was a period in Sri Lanka's history where the key agents of change, where the key stakeholders, all chose to do certain things and chose not to do certain things. And through those collective actions and inactions, it had consequences for the whole country, but for me, as I feel it most personally and most profoundly, it had consequences for the Tamil people in the north and the east. It had consequences for those, you know, 5,000 to 300,000 people that were ultimately moved across the island and then finally trapped on that spit of land on that beach, and for the 5,000 to 100,000 people that were slaughtered. And so for me, 2009, or this novel, is my way of exploring what happened there, what did happen, what didn't happen, and what should have happened, and the consequences for those people, for our people.
V The issue of media suppression is obviously very relevant to Sri Lanka, where violence against journalists and news outlets that have been critical of the government have been a constant feature of the war. Sri Lanka has been listed on the Committee to Protect Journalists Global Impunity Index every single year since the formation of that index in 2008, and it only dropped off the list for the first time this year, partly because of initiatives started by the current government to supposedly demonstrate their commitment to transitional justice, namely the investigation into the murder of Lasantha Wickramathunga. But that investigation has been ongoing for several years and has not produced any meaningful results. Furthermore, a recent report from Groundviews released just this month in December 2017 demonstrates that the issue of media suppression is still very alive and well in Sri Lanka. The report revealed that the Sri Lankan government has blocked 13 news sites since 2015, citing reasons such as damaging the president's reputation and publishing false information. It is now 9 years after the end of the war, and there has clearly been little progress or meaningful steps towards accountability and reconciliation in this area, as well as other areas, a good example of which would be the Office of the Missing Persons, which has done very little to address the issue of disappeared persons on the island, both during the war and after the war. We've also seen less political activism by the diaspora regarding these failings, in comparison to the type of activism we saw in 2009, when the diaspora really mobilized to protest the Sri Lankan military's conduct in that final bloody phase of the war. Do you think we, and when I say we, I'm referring to Sri Lanka's citizens, the international community, and the diaspora, have we all just become a little apathetic about these issues since 2009?
That's a good question. Has the international community and the diaspora, I think human memory is a strange, unfortunate and fickle thing, really. And it happens in every conflict, it happens in every tragedy, in every natural disaster. And it happens to us all. You know, 20,000 people die in an earthquake in Turkey or in Iran, and it eventually leaves my consciousness, and I am a reasonably socially motivated person. It is incumbent on where communities have that personal connection, because you can't rely on the broader international community. You can only rely, you can first and foremost rely on your own people. And it is incumbent on us to continue to remind ourselves of what happened then and what happens now and what role we can play in it, if anything. It's also something that has to be surveyed generationally. So the diasporic younger generation, you know, the sort of 10 to 45-year-olds who have largely been raised in the West, have less of a visceral, physical connection to the land and the people. And that is simply the way it is. The question is, what do we do with that? Do we choose to be a community that is simply a floating cyber community? Do we choose to be a community that is just connected to our new homelands, to Canada, to Sydney? Or do we choose to try to see ourselves as a community that still has a relationship to the country from which we came, and therefore a duty to the country from which we came? And that question only becomes more intensified and more urgent as the generations go on. So, you know, who will my children see themselves as? I have four children aged 14 to 7. You know, will they regard themselves as having some kind of powerful duty to the Tamil people in Sri Lanka, and in what way will they give voice to that, or will they manifest that in action?
Sri Lanka, despite a change in government that was hoped to bring about real change, remains a country where the narrative and the story is very much controlled through formal and informal means, and where so many of the ground realities are not adequately reported on. As an author, what role do you see fiction playing in countering that controlled narrative?
I think fiction has an incredible role to play in that, actually. And I have started my journey as an author feeling very apologetic about being an author and very concerned that I actually don't have the right to necessarily explore those issues or engage in in those issues through fiction. And so to give you an example, when I was in Sri Lanka in January this year, I interviewed a really good cross-section of people, of Sri Lankans, Tamils, Sinhalese, people from different socioeconomic groups, people from different professions. And when I interviewed civil society activists or journalists who themselves work at the front line, I would say to them, look, I recognize that I am a Sri Lankan Tamil aspiring author from the West, and that I am cognizant of the fact that you have genuinely sacrificed so much. You have put your lives, you have put your families on the line for the things that you believe in, and now I am going to interview you about that to create fiction from it. So please tell me if you are happy for me to be here and talk to you about these issues. And their response, Jess, was so interesting and consistent across the board. It was, please talk to us. Talk to us. Let us tell you what is happening and use our stories in your fiction. Because without the truth being told, without these stories coming out into the public space, there can be no real reconciliation and there can be no real justice. And if the public space, if the narratives within the public space are controlled, if they are sanitized, and if they are shut down, then fiction can do something that journalism or that political expression cannot. I felt so humbled by those conversations and so blessed to have these people being willing to generously share their experiences with me. And then to give me, effectively to give me license, I felt, to talk about those issues and to use fiction to talk about those issues.
And I suppose that's the irony sort of in the situation is that, you know, in a political climate that doesn't allow for a free and independent media, we've turned to fiction to obtain the truth.
Absolutely. You know, so in my first novel, I felt very bound by history, bound by it. I felt constrained by it and burdened by it. I felt I had a duty to stay as historically accurate as I could. In my second novel, I allowed myself to venture into what's effectively pure fiction because it's a dystopic future. It's set in the year 2040 in a world that has not happened yet. But drawing on history, drawing on colonialism, drawing on the past in order to inform the future. For the third book, set in 2009, I asked myself, how historically accurate am I going to be? And, you know, the worry or the concern is that when you deviate from history in one aspect of your novel and people go, oh, that's completely fictional, that's not fact, does it then undermine the veracity of the other parts of your novel where you are actually factually correct? So I am, you know, exploring things that actually happened, the constraint and the crushing of the freedom of press, the killing of journalists, the, you know, the political manipulations by different governments, the sale of weapons, the ultimate genocide that happened in the East at the very end. All of those things, I think most people would say, are factually correct. But then at times, I allow myself to veer into fiction. And the conversation that I had with myself around this in the end was, you know, if history is ultimately written by the victor, and if history is, it is presented to us as a series of facts, this actually happened, says the victor. But we know that history, as written by the victor, is often as much fiction as it is fact. It is at times more fictitious than it is factual. And so if governments can do that, and if historians and academics on the payroll of the victor can also do that, if they can present fiction as fact, then I should be allowed to present fact as fiction and have the reader ask themselves, did this really happen? And if it did really happen, that is a terrible, terrible thing.
Shankar, your second book is The Barrier, and as you mentioned, it's set in the year 2040 in Sri Lanka, in a world destroyed by an Ebola pandemic and religious wars. It's the story of how war, disease, biotechnology, and religion intertwine to create a dystopic future. 2018 is quite literally around the corner, and 2040 really isn't that far off. What is your hope in your ideal world for Sri Lanka by the year 2040?
For my ideal hope for 2040 is that Sri Lanka is a country that acknowledges what it did to itself, that the people of Sri Lanka acknowledge the heinous tragedies, that we acknowledge our capacity for brutality and we acknowledge our capacity for good, and that we rebuild a country on that honesty. And it takes courage to be honest. And so my prayer for Sri Lanka is that we have the courage to be honest about who we are and what we've done. And based on that honesty, that we are then able to ask ourselves, what kind of country do we want for our children? And, you know, that is really ultimately, I think, the question that every person has to ask for themselves, whether you have children or not, because you will leave that country behind for them, and they will go into that brave new world with the legacy of what you have done and what you have left for them. And so in 2018, Sri Lanka is poised in this position, in this historic moment, to create the future that it wants. And I think what it wants is a country in which all people are equal, where people are heard, where that multiplicity of histories, that multiplicity of voices, of cultures, of languages, of religions, of needs is heard. A country that is not afraid to acknowledge that it has different ethnicities, and that acknowledgement of those different ethnicities doesn't actually have to break the country. It doesn't have to divide the country. It doesn't have to result in a secessionist land dispute. It doesn't have to lead it towards war. It simply leads it to the acknowledgement that we are different and we are the same. And our constitution, our rights, our laws, our economy, our education system, our employment opportunities, our investment, and the way that our military and our police and our government treats each citizen is equal, it is fair, it is right, and it is just. And we are a country that ultimately operates and respects the rule of law. That is where we are. That is what we have the potential to create in 2018, which, as you say, is just around the corner. And that is what, if we do the right things and we do them bravely, have the potential to create for 2040.
Shankari, on a personal level, it's truly been a pleasure speaking with you, both as a fellow diaspora Tamil and also as a law student myself. It's been inspiring to hear about how you've leveraged your training and your skill set as a lawyer to contribute to change in Sri Lanka in a manner that resonates with you through writing and through fiction. There are a lot of members of the diaspora who want to do something and be part of the change Sri Lanka requires to address the roots of this conflict, but perhaps don't know where to even begin or how to do so, because I think the task can seem so daunting at times, particularly when the problem that needs to be addressed is as systemic as an entire political system. Do you have any advice for those young people on how they can find their place and their role in contributing to that change?
I'm right there with them, Jess. I'm right there with those young people, even though I'm much older than all of you. I think it's a question you have to ask yourself every day. There is no right answer. There is no good answer. There is only, as my father told me, that the Gita told him, do your best. Ask yourself what your best is, what are your strengths, what are your weaknesses, what are your skills, and recognize that what you do, and I feel this very strongly for myself and for my children, that what you do, the small things, the micro actions that you do collectively create macro actions, and they collectively create change in the world. There's an organization here in Australia that was founded by two or three young Sri Lankan Tamil women, and they themselves have a background in social policy. Some of them have a background in social policy, but they also within the group have an interesting skill set. Some are from marketing and so on. And they went to Sri Lanka and spent some time in the region around Kilinochchi, And they eventually were inspired to set up a charity called Palmera. And it works primarily with women on economic empowerment. So assisting them in getting back into meaningful employment and creating those employment, sustainable employment opportunities for them, both at the skills and the enterprise level. And the way that they did it was so interesting in that they spent a lot of time creating relationships with local delivery organizations. So local community organizations that were doing well, local community leaders, and then engaging with the actual stakeholders, with their actual community, and saying, how can we create long-term sustainable support for you to ultimately be empowered to create your own livelihood? Part of what drove them was this need to create an organization that bridged the gap between my generation or that younger generation of Sri Lankan Tamils in the diaspora and their sort of amorphous desire to do something, but a lack of clarity on what that something might be, and this community in Sri Lanka that we are, that we care for and feel connected to, but don't know how to support. So it's really for those young people in the diaspora internationally who are looking for organizations to engage with or are looking for models to set up themselves or to support, Palmera is probably a really good one to explore.
The last question I have for you, Shankari, or I should probably say set of questions, is a lightning round so that the people can get to know you a little bit better. So I'm going to jump into it. Feel free to elaborate wherever you feel necessary. And here we go. A day of hiking or a day at the beach?
A day of hiking.
Dogs or cats?
Definitely dogs.
I agree with you, but I do think cats have gotten a bad rep.
Yeah, there is only one cat in the world, my neighbor's cat that I look after when they go on holidays. I just find that dogs, they give to me so unconditionally, and perhaps I'm needy like that, but I love my dog.
A good cup of tea or a good cup of coffee?
Oh, good cup of coffee. Good cup of coffee any day.
Puttu or idiyappam?
Puttu with omelette, Sri Lankan omelette, with pol sambal, and maybe with the aubergine curry. Maybe I could actually go just straight omelette and pol sambal.
You're saying all the right things right now.
Do you know, when I traveled the world, just when I was 23, I traveled the world, and as part of that, I agreed to with my grandparents and my parents that I would stop in different countries where we had family members. And every place that I went, they had clearly spoken to my grandmother by then. Every single place I went, they made me puttu, omelette, and bol sambal.
Just goes to show that Tamil food has no borders.
That's right. That's right. Love it.
A good comedy or a good drama?
A good drama.
Chris Hemsworth
Yeah.
or Liam Hemsworth?
Okay, so I am very fickle on this one, I must admit, but I think lately, because I've just seen Thor, it'll be Chris Hemsworth. So recently, my family and I, because my children don't, they're not allowed to eat sweets, we opted out of Halloween. And instead of trick or treating this year, we took them to see Thor Ragnarok with my parents. And my mother, in the middle of the movie, leans over and says to me, "Who is this man? He's very handsome."
He is, and for that reason, I agree with you, Chris. Okay, last question. A young Justin Trudeau or a young Malcolm Turnbull?
Oh, that is not even a
That's a
question. A
toughie.
young Justin Trudeau, a Justin Trudeau at any age.
At any age, honestly. Shankari, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been such a pleasure talking to you and learning about your books and learning about the message that they send and the audience that they reach. I think the work that they're doing is so important. So thank you so much for sitting down with us and having this conversation. And best of luck in the new year and in Sri Lanka this January at the Fairway Gall National Literary Prize.
Thank you so much for having me, Jess. It's been wonderful.
Thanks for joining us, guys. You've been listening to part two of SLWB's interview with Shankri Chandran, the Australian Tamil author of three novels, Song of the Sun God, The Phantom Limb, and The Barrier, which explore the past, present, and future of Sri Lanka through the various issues that reside at the root of its conflict. You can learn more about Shankri and her novels at her website, shankrichandran.com, and connect with her on Twitter, at @ShankriAuthor. You can get your copy of Shankri's novel, The Song of the Sun God, via her website and also through Tamil Culture's online marketplace, TC Market. My name is Jessica J. Sudhasan, and you've been listening to SLWB's podcast series, Speakeasy, which aims to bridge the gap between Sri Lanka's communities and create a path for open, honest conversation about those topics typically only discussed in closed circles. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you guys next time.